Docket for today, MB versus RB, and we'll hear that case today. Your panel today, to my left, in his initial voyage for oral argument, Justice Brian Walker. I've not sat on an oral argument for over a year, so this will be my first oral argument in a long time, and I'm very glad we're having it. And then to my right is Justice Mike Wallach, and I am Wade Birdwell. And to give you some idea of the turnover that this court has had in the last 3 years, I've only been on the court for 3 years, and I'm the old man on the bunch. So anyway, we're ready to hear the case. Bonnie, if you just announce and get us going. Thank you.
Good afternoon, and may it please the court. There are three independent bases for why this court should reverse the entry of the divorce decree and remand this proceeding back to the trial court. First and foremost, binding Texas Supreme Court precedent establishes that a party to a contested divorce proceeding is entitled to 45 days notice before final entry of a judgment in the divorce decree based on a mediated settlement agreement. Here, the record shows on its face that MB did not receive any notice, much less the requisite 45 days notice, before the trial court entered the final divorce decree on the MSA. Accordingly, this court should remand and reverse the entry of the judgment so that MB may have the opportunity to receive the due process that she was denied below. Second, as an alternative basis for remand, the terms of the divorce decree improperly vary from those in the MSA. This is an abuse of discretion under Texas law. Due to the cumulative effect of the variations between the decree and the MSA, including provisions awarding new property to RB that was not contemplated in the MSA, and the fact that the decree was purported to be an agreed judgment when it was not, this court should exercise its discretion and remand this case back to the trial court for further proceedings. Finally, as another alternative basis for remand, which this court need not reach if it remands on either the other two bases, there are essential elements missing from the divorce decree and the MSA, and this absence highlights a potential ambiguity in the MSA that the trial court should have the opportunity to address in the first instance. Any one of these bases justifies remanding this case back to the trial court. I'll begin with discussing the due process issue. Under the Texas Family Code, a party to a suit for dissolution of marriage is entitled to judgment on a mediated settlement agreement if that agreement satisfies the statutory requirements of Section 6.602 of the Texas Family Code. However, judgment on a 6.602 mediated settlement agreement is not automatic if a divorce is contested. Instead, when a divorce falls into the contested category, Texas Rule of Civil Procedure 245 requires that the spouses receive proper notice before that right to judgment is realized.
Ms. Fitzgerald, real quick, not to apologize for cutting you off, just before you go further in that area, at some point in the facts, there's some assertion that the husband, I'm going to just say husband and wife, or like just make it easy, that the wife was actually present. And I know you're the appellant, and this may be on the scope of what you know, but do you have any idea why that was the case, why there was this assertion that she was present? At first, it kind of threw me off in reading through the facts. Are you familiar with that?
So the record indicates that no hearing ever occurred. The trial court crossed out in the final decree that the court heard the motion, and so it indicated that it was submitted and then entered. Also, there is no indication that either the wife or her attorney appeared at any such hearing. Instead, the record, if you look at the trial court's docket, it's completely blank. There's just no evidence that a hearing occurred at all. I'm not sure why there was some kind of fact alleged about that, and I don't believe it was in the briefing. It might have been just somewhere else in the record, or in the motion to dismiss. However, there is no evidence to support that a hearing occurred at any point in time.
Okay.
And what about notice?
Go ahead.
I mean, I know we've been told there's no notice, but, and you know, it's kind of hard to prove a negative, but you know, you're telling us that there's absolutely whatsoever no notice at all in this case. There was no kind of substitute notice. There was nothing like that. It was absolutely no notice. Is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor. So there are two, it's a two-sided prong to that. First of all, there was notice of the motion for entry of judgment. However, that notice was only of the motion. There was no notice of a hearing on that motion, and there was no subsequent inside of that motion, and there was no subsequent notice of a hearing that was set for that motion. That notice of the motion was only given to my client's former counsel, and that was only 3 days before the divorce decree was entered. So even if the attorney-client relationship was still existing at that time, which, as our brief indicates, it was not, that notice would still be insufficient under Rule 245 because it's not 45 days.
Do you have any idea who signed the order, who signed the final decree? Because it clearly doesn't look like it was Judge Wells, and it also doesn't look like it was Associate Judge DeAngelis. Do you have any idea who signed the order?
No, Your Honor, I do not.
Okay.
Best of my knowledge.
I mean, both of y'all, in both of your briefs, you identified Judge Wells as the judge, and she is the judge of that particular family district court, but the signature doesn't look like her signature, and the signature doesn't look like a signature for a Lori DeAngelis either. And so I was kind of wondering who ended up signing off on this when nobody else had signed off on it, because it didn't look like either one of the judges did. My second question, counsel, is that you're asking us to assume that there was no hearing. You're arguing there's no hearing for two reasons. One is that whoever signed the final decree marked it out at the very beginning and said where it said that this was heard and said that it was done based upon consideration of the MSA. That's the first ground. The second ground is that the docket sheet has no entries on it whatsoever. One of the issues that we've started having with the family courts, however, is a lot of their docketing apparently is being done on their case management system, okay? And so I'm not aware of a single case that says anything about whether or not a case management system docket entry or entry constitutes an entry of judgment under the family code provision that allows for docket entries to be renditions, okay? And here, would the case management system be a part of the record that you've got to demonstrate as being part of that on the face of the record allows you your restricted appeal? And given the fact that nobody briefed that, and that is some completely out of left field, I'll just wait and see how best you do with it. And I'm going to ask the same thing over here as well. That may be require some additional briefing. I don't know. We'll see.
Well, Your Honor, we alleged in our briefing that no hearing occurred. Moreover, certainly not that my client or her former counsel attended the hearing. In the response brief, there is no allegation that the hearing did in fact occur. I believe that the fact that you were referring to earlier was in the motion to dismiss. So in the briefing itself, it was not contested. And under the Texas Rules of Appellate Procedure, a non-contested fact is taken as true in the Court of Appeals. So I think that this court would be fair to assume that there was no hearing. Moreover, that my client nor her attorney at the time had appeared if there was a hearing.
Okay.
Importantly, this case does not involve a consent decree. MB is not asking this court to determine if Rule 245's notice requirements would apply in a contested proceeding in which the parties entered into a binding consent decree. Moreover, this case does not involve a waiver issue. MB also does not ask this court to determine if Rule 245's notice proceeding provisions would apply in a contested proceeding in which a party waived the right to notice for a final hearing. Instead, this case presents a very limited question. In a contested divorce proceeding, was MB entitled to notice before the judgment on the MSA was realized when MB did not waive the right to notice of the final hearing and MB did not consent to the proposed decree? And the answer must be yes. And there are several important reasons for this. As the Texas Supreme Court recognized in Highsmith, judgment on a Section 6.602 mediated settlement agreement is not automatic. Instead, even when the parties have executed a statutorily compliant mediated settlement agreement, the parties may avail themselves of applicable statutory defenses or otherwise move to set aside the agreement before judgment is rendered thereon. This court, likewise, recognized that judgment on Section 6.602 MSAs is not automatic in Boyd versus Boyd. In Boyd, this court stated that Section 6.602 mediated settlement agreements are not immune from judicial review, and held that a trial court is not required to enforce an MSA simply because it complies with Section 6.602, irrespective of what the agreement provides for or how it was procured. Instead, this court recognized that when a Section 6.602 MSA contains illegal provisions or was procured by duress, fraud, or other dishonest means, that the trial court has discretion to refuse to enter judgment on the MSA. Importantly, this appeal is not about the merits of a challenge to the MSA. This appeal is about whether my client was denied the opportunity to make those arguments in the trial court below. Because MB did not consent to the proposed final decree and did not waive her right to notice on a final hearing on that decree, the fact that MB did not receive notice before the trial court entered the unagreed decree stripped her of her opportunity to challenge the MSA at a meaningful time and in a meaningful manner. As the Texas Supreme Court held, this lack of notice violates basic principles of due process. In Highsmith, the parties to a contested divorce proceeding entered into a 6.602 mediated settlement agreement. After entering into the agreement, Charles Highsmith filed for divorce. Meredith Highsmith entered a general denial, after which Charles moved to have entry for judgment on the mediated settlement agreement. Charles attended a hearing on the court's uncontested docket, testified to the insupportability of the marriage, and then asked the court to render judgment on the MSA, which the court did. Meredith did not receive notice of the hearing and thus did not attend. The Texas Supreme Court reversed entry of the divorce decree and remanded the proceeding back to the trial court because Meredith was improperly denied of her right to notice of the hearing at which the trial court rendered judgment in the divorce proceeding. At the Supreme Court, Charles argued that doesn't matter. At this point in time, there was no more contest. The parties had settled all issues by the MSA. The Texas Supreme Court summarily rejected that argument, stating the argument misses the point for several reasons. First, the court expressly stated that the existence of an MSA in and of itself does not change the contested nature of a proceeding. Moreover, the court recognized that disputes may still arise post-execution and that parties have a right to avail themselves of the statutory defenses to challenge an MSA. Thus, the Supreme Court held that Meredith was entitled to notice of the hearing so that she could have the opportunity to contest the party's MSA prior to the rendition of judgment for that very reason. Additionally, the court discussed the interplay between Section 6.602 and Texas Rule of Civil Procedure 245, and the court noted that 6.602 governs MSAs in divorce suits, while Rule 245 sets forth the general notice requirements for all litigants. The court held Rule 245 does not deprive a spouse of his or her right to entry of judgment on a statutorily compliant MSA. It simply requires that the other spouse be properly notified before the right to judgment is realized. Under Highsmith, the same result should occur here. It is undisputed that this divorce proceeding was contested.
Ms. Fitzgerald, question on this. I'm not a family law attorney, never was, and so... Just assuming I know nothing about family law, I know a little bit. There was this assertion and there was some dialogue that kind of back and forth, if you will, in the briefings on, you know, was it contested or was it not contested? And there was this idea that clearly, I think in your brief, y'all stated that because it was a general denial was filed, it is contested. And that I think the other side argued, in essence, that because there had been an MSA, it wasn't contested anymore. It had lost its contested nature. Does Highsmith or any other case law, because I didn't see any citations in your brief to this assertion, is there case law that says, or is there some other authority that says, that when you file a general denial, that the nature of the case is to be considered contested throughout the life, if you will, of the case? Are you familiar with any authority that makes that assertion? Because you kind of allude to it, but I didn't actually see a citation that I could find in the brief.
Well, Well, I would argue that Highsmith does support that. Highsmith states that the filing of a general denial makes the proceeding contested, and also states that the existence of an MSA does not change the nature of that proceeding. I think it makes sense that you would have it based on the concept of what the pleading is, because otherwise you'd have a lot of substantive digging around to see, is it still contested, is it not, whereas the trial court can look at its docket and see if there was a general denial. Yes, we're in the contested case category. If there's not, then we're in the uncontested category. I think asking the trial court to look in further at the MSA, for example, if an MSA only covers certain issues and other issues remain at dispute, that would be pretty taxing on the trial courts to try to figure out before deciding how they're going to handle these cases.
Thank you.
But moreover, RB acknowledges that this case is contested in his brief to this court. On page 6, he states, this is a restricted appeal from the trial court's entry of a final divorce decree in a contested case. Thus, the nature of the proceeding in this court is uncontested. It is further undisputed that MB did not receive notice of and did not appear at any hearing on RB's motion for entry of judgment on the divorce decree. RB filed his motion for entry of judgment on March 19, 2019. It did not contain notice of a hearing, and nor was there a separate notice of hearing set on that motion. The trial court entered its judgment on March 22nd, 2019. And I see I'm out of time. I will save the rest of my time for rebuttal, unless
you have questions. One final question, and that is, do we need to reach your second and third grounds if we accept that Highsmith controls whether or not this judgment should have been entered or not? And if we do it just on Highsmith, do we just kick it back and vacate the judgment and remand it, and we don't reach the other two issues that you've raised? Would that be the appropriate thing to do under the circumstances?
Correct, Your Honor. You do not need to reach either of the other two issues if you remand on the first issue.
Right.
And if you remand in full, allow my client to have her opportunity to challenge the MSA in the first place.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
You may.
Thank you, and may it please the court. So we primarily focused on the notice issue. I will quickly address the other two and go back to the notice. In regard to appellant's argument that the final decree that was entered varies from the mediated settlement agreement that was initialed on every page and signed by all the parties and their attorneys, that's not a correct statement of the facts. The final decree contains all the portions of the mediated settlement agreement and the additional language found in the family law practice manual, which is referred to in the mediated settlement agreement.
Isn't it pretty clear, though, that the final decree juxtaposed the first and third and second and fourth weekends?
It did flip them. However, that's not a substantive change. It's not a material change. No one gained or lost anything.
Okay, so you're not arguing that the final decree tracks exactly the mediated settlement agreement. You're arguing that there's no real substantive difference between the two.
Yes.
Okay.
I'm sorry. How do we determine whether something is material or not if there's a difference?
It would be a similar analysis to what is a material and substantial change.
Well, I mean, to the people who entered into an agreement, there could be important issues on the first and third versus second and fourth, which we don't know about, possibly.
Could be.
Okay.
And just to make it clear on the record, you're appellate counsel, and I didn't see your name anywhere on any of the trial documents, including the mediated settlement agreement. So,
yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
Thank you. And then the final issue in regard to being able to undo the MSA on bases of fraud, duress, coercion, there's simply no evidence of that before the court.
Well, but there wasn't a hearing that would have allowed the presentation of that evidence for purposes. So, I mean, clearly we are limited in this appeal to whatever is on the record. And since there does not appear to have been an actual hearing where that type of evidence could have been presented. Obviously, that evidence is not going to be on the record for us to be able to deal with. Okay, same question I asked counsel. Do you have any idea who signed this final decree of divorce?
I haven't looked at the signature recently enough to tell you. I'm very familiar with Judge Wells' signature and DeAngelis. If there's a copy of it floating around somewhere, I could look. But off the top of my head, no, Your Honor, I don't know.
Okay. If you figure it out, you might send us a letter. It appears to be two names that start what appear to be a very large J on both of them. I mean, I didn't see anybody associated with any of the family district courts, judge or associate judge, that has any names like that one way or the other. So I'm guessing it was a visiting judge probably, but don't know. It'd be nice to know because, you know, and the reason I'm asking, okay, is if it was Associate Judge DeAngelis, okay, then that was a trial hearing on the merits, that the family code has certain requirements and the local rules have certain requirements before an associate judge can enter a final judgment with regard to parties, and the parties have to have an opportunity to object to an associate judge issuing a final judgment. So if this was, in fact, Judge DeAngelis, there's nothing in the record that indicates there was 10 days given for the opportunity for anybody to object to that to occur. So that's why it came up. That's why I looked at it and was looking at it, and I still don't know the answer to that because nobody knows who that signature is. But that would be a concern of mine that would be on the face of the record, that in fact somebody who didn't have the authority to sign actually signed the judgment, which would be another ground for reversal under the circumstances. So anybody who wants to provide that information, if it exists, we'd be happy to hear about that. So I think I'm finished with regard to that.
Counsel, you said that there's nothing in the record about duress. And I don't know if I heard you right or not, but I assume you're talking about at the mediation and after that at some hearing that did or didn't exist, probably didn't happen. Is that what you're saying? You're saying there's just no proof of duress at all?
Well, both. There is no proof of duress at all.
Yeah.
But importantly, I believe the analysis that allows you to undo a mediated settlement agreement surrounds the mediation itself, that it was procured by fraud, duress, another illegal means.
Well, there is some discretion. There's some discussion in the briefing with regard to mom's counsel not showing up till late in the mediation. That's nowhere in the record. I'm not sure how we ended up with that. Okay, so we understand we're limited to the record, and therefore we can only consider certain things that are in the record. I need you to get to the due process argument because Highsmith looks like it pretty much controls what we're going to do here. So what's your best argument about why Highsmith doesn't control here?
To put it succinctly, it creates an absurd result. Appellant was petitioner in the trial court. The case had been on file for quite some time before they went to mediation. The parties voluntarily and represented by counsel attended mediation on November 30th and filed the report with the court that mediation was successful, resulted in a full settlement a few days later, approximately 5 days later, and nothing was done for about 60 days. Then the court sends out a notice of dismissal for want of prosecution.
Okay, where is that in the record?
On the docket? There's the notice of the dismissal.
There's not any, the docket sheet that we've got, there's not a single entry on that docket, which is why I raised the question about the case management system, because the docket sheet, I didn't see anything on it. Maybe I'm missing it in the record, but I'm looking at the green docket sheet and there's not a single entry on it, which is why she's also arguing that she didn't even get notice that the judgment had been entered.
Okay. So there was a pleading essentially that was sent out by the court the notice for dismissal.
Can you give us a page number in the record where we can find that?
Not off the top of my head, no.
Because in going through the record, I didn't see that either. The docket sheet that I saw was absolutely blank, and the only indication that I saw in the record about anything being potentially set was a motion for the entry of judgment according to the MSA on March the 19th, and then 3 days later, it signed saying considered and struck out heard.
There was also a motion with regard to an interview of Simeon, I think, and that was.
Well, that was different.
Those are the only two things that I'm aware of that the court was asked to actually ever rule on.
And I don't know that there was ever a hearing set on that.
I don't know that there was either. I just know the motion's in the record. Let's assume, and give you an opportunity to give us a citation of the record. But if what you're saying is correct, that in fact there was a notice of dismissal for want of prosecution sent out by the trial court, why would that change? How does that impact the application of Highsmith?
Absolutely. It was sent on January 30th, and the hearing for the dismissal was noticed for March 22nd. And that was 51 days notice that if nothing happens, your case is going to be disposed of. And then the motion to enter the final decree was filed on March 19, and there was a notice for hearing on March 22nd as well. And so...
Okay, that's nowhere in the record. I know that's not in the record. And the reason I know that's in the record is the motion for entry of the final decree, the prayer does not ask for a hearing. And the argument for attorney's fees, because Cordell and Cordell is irritated that opposing counsel didn't prepare the final decree, they ask for attorney's fees, one, for having to prepare the final decree, and two, if there is a hearing but didn't ask for one, we want our attorney's fees with regard to that. And technically, there's no ruling in the record on that request for attorney's fees, but... I think that gets wiped out by the layman language at the end of the final decree, which says this is final and appealable type of thing. So it never got ruled on, but it's effectively ruled on by that language. But we're going to need to see where in the record there's a – so what you're telling us right now is that you think the record reflects – that there was a hearing set for dismissal for want of prosecution on March 22nd, which just happened to be the day the final decree got entered, okay? But what would have indicated to Mom in this instance or her attorney that the motion for entry of final decree was going to be heard on that date?
There was a separate notice of hearing filed.
Okay.
I don't know that it got signed by a judge.
I'm telling you that's not in the record, but you're going to need to put up on that one, okay? So, okay. But that's why you're distinguishing Highsmith here.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
Just out of curiosity, how come you didn't lay that out in your appellee's brief so that we would have that information readily available and could check the citations to the record that you're claiming exist?
I don't have a good answer for that. I think the truth is I got kind of caught up focusing on appellant's argument as opposed to looking at it with fresh eyes with my own perspective of it. It's not a good answer, but... I reviewed it this morning and realized that there was 51 days notice of a hearing on a dismissal and that the entry was the same day.
If you don't want me to ask you, where did you see that this 51 days? In your notes, I mean, because obviously we're having a problem with it being in our record. Mm-hmm. How do you know this?
I practice regularly in the Tarrant County family law courts and have the online access.
Okay.
And those are in the filings, the petition.
So you saw it on the computer system?
Mm-hmm.
Through the clerk's office, the district clerk's office.
Yes.
You pay that.
$35 a month.
Yeah, and go through Tom Wilder's system. Yep.
Okay, so you're wanting us to accept notice of a dismissal for want of prosecution 51 days before the hearing on the dismissal for want of prosecution complies with Rule 245 because it's more than 45 days notice of a final trial on the merits, even though the maximum amount of notice that could have been had on the entry of the final decree would have been 3 days. Well, and I'm not even sure the 3 days met the local rule because you don't count the day it was filed. It was filed on the 19th, so maybe. I always have fun with that rule. So
the argument is that the parties entered into the mediated settlement agreement and it purports to be a full and final settlement and on November 30. And then the notice for the dismissal didn't come out until January 30. And so at that point, there's already a binding enforceable MSA that parties are entitled to entry of at any time, according to the family code. And then you're getting 51 days notice that a final disposition will happen on this day.
But you're telling us right now that there are two notices of a hearing, of two separate hearings on the 22nd, one that was issued by the trial court itself based upon a dismissal for one of prosecution docket that was sent out 51 days beforehand, and then there was one done with regard to the motion on the motion for entry of final decree that was sent out as well, neither of which we have in this record. Okay. But you're telling me that based upon you're looking at it today, those are in there, but for some reason that's nowhere in your brief to begin with.
Yes.
So this is your understanding, we're hearing this for the first time and we could have never known about it because it's nowhere in your briefing and it's nowhere in the record, right?
Yes, sir.
Okay. And you don't have a good answer for that.
No.
Your candor is appreciated, counsel.
And the date you said for the motion for entry of final decree, that was noticed when, according to what you saw today?
I know. So the motion was filed March 19, and there was a notice filed that said there would be a hearing on the 22nd. I believe it was filed the 19th. But I will not be as
so. But 3 days at the most.
At the most, yes.
Okay, so you're not saying that was 50 something days.
No.
Okay.
Okay. And just for the record, you also filed a motion to dismiss, and you didn't cite any of those purported facts in your motion to dismiss either, did you?
It would appear not.
Well, one of the things you did was you did point out that there was an initial motion to withdraw filed by her counsel on the 14th, which is not in the record, but apparently it's not in our record. We only have the one that was filed on the 18th, okay?
Yeah, they're absolutely two.
The interesting thing in both of them is that her counsel did not inform her of the doo-wop date, okay? What are we to do with that? We're just supposed to intuit to her the fact that because he knew about it, but he's withdrawing, but he's not telling her about it, and we don't even have a hearing set, didn't even get a hearing set on his motion to withdraw, but somehow we're just going to intuit to her all of that information about all of those notices. Because the doo-wop, he was obligated ethically to tell her that it was set for dismissal for want of prosecution on the 22nd. Okay, all right.
If I may, and I don't want to put words in your mouth, but I just want to make sure I understand what your position is. Is it your position that because there was what you believe is a enforceable final MSA, and there was a decree, a purported decree that was apparently presented to somebody for signature, and that decree did not materially vary from that MSA, then we should, in essence, just have to affirm. We would have to just follow the decree because it didn't materially change, if you will. Is that correct?
That's
your position?
Argument A. Argument B would be that the case could be remanded to the trial court, but for entry on the mediated settlement agreement.
Right, and so you would concede then that we really don't have the MSA before us on this appeal. We're looking at, I mean, we can't, obviously, we don't have really the jurisdiction or the authority at this point to decide whether that the MSA is enforceable or final. We're looking at whether or not what took place with this decree is final and affirmable, if you want to call it that. Is that, do you agree with that?
Well, I believe that the family code says that if a mediated settlement agreement conforms to Chapter 6, that it is enforceable. And I believe the case law says that the property division is not reviewable by the trial court. There are some pretty narrow exceptions for reviewing the best interest child issues that I don't think have been presented here. But that's, I think y'all could rule that the MSA comports with the family code.
Well, and I guess you could see a problem that I see is if you have a shady attorney who gets an MSA and then they want to change basically a whole bunch of the substance into a new decree and then take the decree that's not, that really varies from the MSA and get a judge to sign it, that can't be right.
No, and there is case law in regard to that.
There's case law from this court where en banc this court whacked the attorney and the trial judge up in Graham because a final judgment that mom didn't get notice of ended up including a bunch of stuff that was not asked for in the Sapser pleadings. It's called In Re ED. I wrote a dissent in that case. But all seven justices up here slammed the attorney for doing what he did. Anyway, all right, counsel, finish it, please.
I think my positions, with your help, have been made clear and are fairly simple. I think there was notice of March 22nd being a day that the case could and would be disposed of, and it was disposed of on that day. I do also believe that the decree that was signed comports with the MSA and that there's no evidence to support a remand on the grounds of the MSA being subject to fraud, duress, and coercion.
One final question, because it looks like your time's up, and it really doesn't matter, but I read a lot of records, so I forget facts sometimes. Who was the trial counsel for the appellant? Was he pro se at the time of this decree, or was...
The appellant was represented by Jesse Munguia. Okay. And yes, he had filed a motion to withdraw, but he was never withdrawn.
No, I'm sorry. You're right. You're correct. What about the appellee? I'm sorry.
He was represented.
Okay.
Yes.
And who was that?
Not me.
Okay.
Cordell and Cordell.
The firm was Cordell and Cordell.
Oh, Leland Kirk.
Okay. Leland Kirk.
All right.
Yes.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you all.
All right, first question out of the block. We're limited to the record. How come if those two things exist that she says exist, how come those were not made part of the record in this case?
Your Honor, I just looked through the entire record. It's not in there. I've never seen those before, so I do not know. I also know that if you are an appellee and you want to rely on something that you think is not included in the record, it is your obligation to supplement the record. So as far as the rules of appellate procedure go, if there was something missing, which I was unaware of that there was until today, it would have been on appellee to have added it in.
Okay.
I want to start by addressing the variation discussion. Appellee's counsel claims that the variations were merely, trivial variations, not substantive, not material. The rule of law in Texas is that a judgment on a mediated settlement agreement must be in strict compliance with the terms of the mediated settlement agreement. So any variation is not in strict compliance. Moreover, even if the first and third, second and fourth weekend variations are deemed to be not substantive, there are other variations that are significantly more substantive. Particularly concerning is the variation in which the decree awards RB property that is not contemplated in the MSA. Specifically, the decree awards RB all brokerage accounts, stocks, bonds, mutual funds, and securities registered in respondent's name, together with dividends, splits, and other rights and privileges in connection with them.
Do we know whether any discovery had actually taken place with regard to whether or not any of those things actually existed, or whether this is mere boilerplate that was being used as a go-by from some other final decree?
Your Honor, there's no record on the discovery. As far as I know, there was no discovery. However, this was not mentioned in the MSA, so its inclusion in the decree, which RB's counsel drafted, it came from somewhere. I don't know where, but it did not come from the MSA.
Which gets back to my previous question, is how do we determine what is the test for strict compliance? Is any deviation sufficient? If it's not, then how do we judge whether or not a deviation is material, for lack of a better phrase, so that it's either strict compliance or not strict compliance?
Your Honor, the case law does not indicate that you look for a material deviation. There is case law indicating that you look at a ministerial versus judicial alteration, but it's very clear in Texas that for 6.602 mediated settlement agreements, the judgment has to be in strict compliance, and the trial court does not have any discretion to deviate from the terms of that judgment. Now, whether that be add in the terms of the family code, the general kind of herefore, therefore provisions, that's not the same thing as deviating from the terms. I would think that would probably be more ministerial. But in this case, you have a situation in which several different terms were deviated from, and this court does not need to determine if it's material or not if it sticks to the case law that remands when there's strict compliance is required. Most importantly, these two notices that were discussed just recently are not in the record. A notice of dismissal for want of jurisdiction is not the same as a notice of a hearing on a motion for final judgment. That's the same thing as saying it would be the same as a summary judgment motion. You don't get to deem notice for any kind of hearing to all pending motions.
Wouldn't that depend upon the terms of the dismissal notice or order, which may say in some courts, if the parties don't submit something by a certain date, then they have to be here, or doesn't mean that there's going to be a hearing if it hasn't been disposed of. I don't know how we can speculate as to what the terms of a dismissal order
right.
have sight unseen.
But that still would not be the same as a hearing on the motion for entry of judgment, which was later than the purported notice of dismissal for want of jurisdiction. Since that motion had not yet been filed, I think it would be impossible for it to include a notice on that motion at that time. But more importantly, even if there were a notice along with the motion for entry of judgment, the motion for entry of judgment was still filed only 3 days before the judgment was entered, and that is insufficient notice under the Highsmith rule.
I got a question. The timing on this, it's kind of suspect in that you have what seems to be a fallout from an MSA, and then all of a sudden there's this filing, and 3 days later you get it entered. Are you aware of anything that is outside of the record as to what sped this? What was the impetus? What caused the husband in this case to go and file that as quickly as it seems to have been filed? And of course, that was only a few days after there was a firing, if you will, of an attorney. And so it kind of seemed like, well, somebody got noticed that an attorney had been fired, and then all of a sudden, well, let's get this thing entered and let's get it signed. Is there any kind of anything that you're aware of that was the impetus for that?
May I answer? My time?
Sure, yes, you can.
You can answer.
I am aware of nothing that occurred during that time period. I was not counsel at that time. I am equally as concerned about it as you are. The optics are not great, but I am not aware of anything that occurred during that period. However, we would request that this court reverse the entry of the judgment and remand so that my client may challenge the validity of the MSA in the trial court below. Thank you.
Right. Thank you, counsel. The case is submitted. And we stand adjourned. Thank you all very much.